I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you so much, Olivia. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from the introduction to the book, which give you a little bit of insight, I hope, into what I thought I was doing with the sentences, some of which I'm sure we're about to talk about. I wanted to write a book that was all positives, all pleasure, only about good things. Beautiful sentences, William Gass wrote, are rare as eclipses. I went chasing eclipses. Those moments of reading when the light changes, some darker luster takes over, and things or words seem suddenly obscure, even in the simplest sentence. And you find you have to look twice, more than twice. In 1853, Matthew Arnold proposed what he called literary touchstones, those privileged moments that constitute the best of what has been thought and written, against which the relative worth of other works can be assessed. For good reasons, this is no longer a reputable way to think about literature, the texture of flux and design disappearing in the preservation of mere relics. So, not a treasury then, but something closer, I hope, to a kind of commonplace book, product of haphazard notation, ad hoc noticing. Except, of course, it's not that. The raw notebook would be indecipherable, self-involved. And while I very much like the idea of a book made only of quotations, cento without glosses, notes, or scolium, not even Walter Benjamin, who aspired to something of the sort in his Arcades project, could refrain from commentary and give himself up completely to the dialectic dance of fragments. In each of the 27 pieces that follow, I've tried to describe the affinity I feel for the individual sentence, maybe also for the work it came from and the writer who composed it, but without my figuring in advance how much analysis, how much context, how much rapture or digression I would include. I wrote, as it were, with my nose to the page, wrote for the first time in my life without a plan of the whole thing in mind, wrote from one fragment to the next, feeling for the route that affinity might take me.
I wanted to talk, first of all, about how this book emerged. And by that, I don't just mean how the book itself emerged, but the history of your seduction by the sentence. When does that start? When did you start realizing that you were so beguiled, and when did those beguilements start turning into self?
I talk a little bit in the introduction about this. I say that I, somewhere on some shelves, not these shelves behind me, but not very far away, are about 45 notebooks that go back about 20 years since I first started writing professionally, I suppose you'd have to call it. When I first started writing tiny little book reviews for Time Out magazine that people would pay me for, and laboring over them, as of course one does, right? Laboring for hours over these things that were about that size, the size of a bus ticket. And it was a moment when, having been a student, having been a graduate student, having imagined that I had a kind of academic future ahead of me, and having those hopes kind of dashed, I started to read differently, I suppose. And even though I was writing and publishing very, very modest things, started to kind of amass quotations, passages from writers, some of them writers I'd always loved, but others that I was just discovering. And it seemed like a different way of reading. And so one of the places that the book comes out of is this kind of mulch, this like midden of the back pages of every notebook that I've used for the past 20 years. They have, the very back page has words, and then the penultimate page has sentences. And sometimes they spill backwards, as it were, into the rest of the notebook. But I realize also, and having written that passage in the introduction, that there was, of course, there was a kind of longer practice of being, you know, bewitched, seduced by sentences or by style, by language. But weirdly, as a teenager, you know, when I was, maybe we'll talk a little bit later on about some of the writers that I've been reading since I was a child or since I was an adolescent, I never used to write these things down. They hung about in my head. So the idea of the sentence as a thing that kind of lives on its own, that could be taken out, separated out, is so totally attached for me to a kind of like daily practice of writing, I guess. So that's kind of where one place that the book comes from is that history.
And my impression reading the book, increasingly as I went through, is that it isn't so much perfect sentences, the most well-wrought sentences, as disturbing sentences, strange sentences, sentences that perform conjuring acts, sentences that misbehave, sentences that you can fall into and not easily find your way out. I was quite charmed by that and also interested because it isn't at all the sort of style guide of sentences that one might have expected or that a less interesting writer might have produced. I wondered if we could start with both the shortest and I think one of the strangest sentences in the book, which is Charlotte Bronte, Villette.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, why don't I read you that sentence? But of course, it is the shortest sentence in the book. And curiously, it is one of the few that I have committed to memory. And it simply goes, it's from Villette, and it's from a chapter in Villette called Cloud. And it simply goes, the drug wrought. And it's describing a moment where the heroine of that novel, Lucy Snow, who's this fantastically self-effacing, but actually extraordinarily insightful and knowledgeable and canny narrator. She's the most unreliable narrator of the 19th century English novel. She is drugged. She has had what seems to be a kind of breakdown. She's apparently in love with the teacher that she's working for in Brussels, in the school. Brussels is kind of thinly disguised in the novel. And she's been rejected, or he's leaving at that, or he's about to leave the school at that point. And she falls into this kind of fit of melancholy, of what I guess you might have called hysteria, and so on. She's given this draft of laudanum, I suppose, and she goes to bed. And then she wakes, or she seems to wake, and she goes out into the city and has this extraordinary kind of hallucinatory experience of the city. But it's all introduced by this tiny sentence, the drug wrought. So I was really interested in first of all, in the fact that it's such an unusual sentence for a writer like Bronte. It's so to the point. It's like this little piercing moment. But also the word wrought, which in itself, you know, it has lost lots of its senses over centuries. So now we think of wrought as maybe, what does it describe? Is it, maybe it's something like wreak, you know, to wreak havoc, they wrought havoc. We've confused the senses, the sense of that word. It's actually the past tense of work. So the drug worked, the drug went to work. It has all of these different meanings, even in this tiny little sentence.
There are so many things that you're doing in this book. There are so many things that you're doing with the sentences. Sometimes they produce biographical essays, sometimes they produce critical essays, but the ones that really linger and pay attention to language seem to me so exciting that they can find a word and play over that word and find all sorts of lost meanings or hidden meanings that you might not see on a cursory read. And another one that I was particularly struck by, in fact I think it's really a virtuosic essay, is the James Baldwin sentence. James Baldwin writing about Norman Mailer, and your reading hinges again on a word and sort of trying to understand the mystery of this word. Can we talk about that sentence a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. The sentence from Baldwin, which is from 1961, which from his Esquire essay on Norman Mailer. And it goes, "They thought he was a real sweet au fait cat, but a little frantic." And we should probably say before we discuss it that au fait there is O-F-A-Y, right? And so it's this moment when Baldwin, he's looking back at his friendship with Mailer. They had met in the 50s in Paris, and they'd become friends. And Baldwin says in this essay that he very much considered Mailer a friend. Mailer had then written a number of things, a number of essays or columns for the Village Voice, where he tries to kind of co-opt the idea of hip and the hipster for himself. He's trying to kind of take on what he sees as the kind of, first of all, sexual potency, second, kind of potential for violence, and third, a kind of cultural cachet, which is very much to do with jazz as well as to do with writing, that he sees in black men, essentially, of that moment, late 50s, early 60s. And Baldwin is having none of this, but he waits until 1961, and he writes this essay about Mailer, in which he describes Mailer trying to ingratiate himself with these jazz musicians in Paris in the mid-50s, failing miserably. And he says, "They thought he was a real sweet au fait cat, but a little frantic." And I suppose I love the fact that essay, that sentence, it feels a real sweet au fait cat. It has a kind of like sleek and slow beginning, and then it turns into this very sharp, but a little frantic. It's such a perfect description of Mailer, of Norman Mailer, frantic. But it turns on also on this word au fait, which I first came across in a writer that the two of us greatly admire, Ian Penman, writing years and years ago, and it's a word that he's returned to in recent essays, writing about jazz and writing about hip, writing about the idea of the cool in the mid-20th century. And essentially, au fait, in that spelling, in that usage, means white, but a particular kind of white person who's in a condescending fashion, kind of paying attention to black culture and particularly to music in this essay. And it has a long history at the beginning of the 20th century. There's even some controversy among black writers, journalists writing in newspapers about whether this term is derogatory or not. Mm. So I was kind of interested in tracing that back. Baldwin says in that essay, there's a moment where he uses the word hip, and he says something like, if I'm using my words correctly, you know, so he's really careful about how he's deploying these words, because he knows that a word like hip or a word like cool or a word like au fait is this kind of hostage to fortune for him and for other black intellectuals and the musicians that he's describing, that can be taken, can be co-opted, can be turned, and partly turned against them.
It was so interesting to me. I'm a huge fan of Baldwin, and it's not at all the sentence I would have chosen from him, but what you discovered in it, what you brought out of it, was such a brilliant reading, both of him but also of the period and the sort of tensions and fractures that were going on, which seems to me something that a sentence can do. There's so much embedded in a sentence. There's a parenthesis in the essay about Roland Barthes, in brackets, "or have them changed for them by an editor." And I think that really struck me, because it nods to something that you talk about in a few essays. It certainly comes up in the Joan Didion essay. It's also touched on in Virginia Woolf, and it's touched on Elizabeth Bowen, which is that the sentence that is published is not necessarily the sentence that the writer wrote. And I wanted to just touch on the kind of sentences that I think most please you, and not necessarily the kind of sentences that sub-editors, copy editors, reviewers even, perhaps even readers, like, are taught to like, believe are respectable and correct. And I wondered what you thought about that, whether you thought that the era of these sort of spectacularly strange sentences are coming to an end, or whether something like Twitter means that we're in a new sort of sanctuary of the glorious sentence size. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the question or the point about editing is a really good one.
It runs through, doesn't it? It's touched on.
But I only glancingly, you know, I mean, the there's a sense in which, you know, a really more thorough scholar might have unearthed, you know, different, many more different drafts. I do sometimes talk about different
very, very thoroughly in The Wolf, you pull out different versions. I think that's the only one where, oh no, but in Joan Didion too.
And the Didion too. But I do glancingly touch on this idea that these sentences probably had to, they are survivors of a process, right? And that in some cases, writers actually had to do some work to make sure they survived. So that in itself is kind of interesting to me. I could imagine from the start of this book, a different version that goes right back to your first question and something you said about or implied about the kind of well-formed, well-polished, well-turned, rounded sentence, yeah. Right? I could imagine kind of populating this book entirely with sentences from, I mean, let's just say off the top of our heads, Jane Austen, Nabokov, and so on, the writers who I really love.
Yeah, that really struck me that it isn't that at all.
But I suppose the thing that I wanted to pay attention to once I got started, and the Elizabeth Hardwick sentence was the first one I wrote about. Maybe that's important. Maybe we'll come back to her. It was something that was catching my ear, so that it seems to me that many of the sentences, some of them are extreme, you know, so some of them fly from a kind of any sense of a kind of aesthetically kind of rounded or polished period. But most of them seem to have the thing that's kind of catching my ear, eye, and mind is always this sense that this well-made object is also falling apart or is kind of shaking itself to pieces in some way, or has one's kind of single flaw that's somehow setting off the rest. I realize as I'm saying that I said almost exactly the same thing in my last book about the essay as a form. And I don't know what this is, you know, that I'm attracted time and again to these perfect aesthetic objects that are also somehow like diseased and collapsing. But you're completely right. And I think that's the thing that I'm trying in a lot of the essays. So some are doing other things, but in a lot of them, I'm trying to kind of find my way in between the kind of perfection of the thing and its weirdness, its strangeness, the thing that doesn't kind of quite make sense. Or I'm trying to kind of bring out the fact that it doesn't quite make sense in sentences that maybe seem sort of self-evident or perfected.
This leads us very beautifully into the next question that I was going to ask, which is, for a book on sentences, which one might expect to be sort of an aesthetic object, it was surprisingly personal. We often glimpse you rather endearingly as an undergraduate trying to evade reading things like George Eliot's Middlemarch. And that's very sweet. But there's a sense that you're chasing something in these sentences. These are sentences that have a hold on you. It's not just that you admire them at a distance as a writer looking at other writers. And that an awful lot of them, and you sort of touched on this in your introduction as well, are to do with death and disappearance. So it comes to feel to the attentive reader that there's something you're chasing, perhaps that you're chasing from book to book. What is it about these moments of opening up that appeals to you so much? Opening up, by which I mean falling down.
Yeah, well, I'm falling down, but somehow holding together at the same time.
And an example, which is a sentence that just knocked me for six in the Hilary Mantel essay, which you really sort of go over with such fascination, and you can feel that it opens up a hole that you're enamored by. Should we have that sentence?
Yeah, let's have Hilary Mantel, which is from the essay that she published in The Guardian on the 20th anniversary, I guess, of the death of Princess Diana. If Diana is present now, it is in what flows and is mutable, what waxes and wanes, what cannot be fixed, measured, confined, is not time-bound, and so renders anniversaries obsolete, and therefore, possibly, not dead at all, but slid into the Alma Tunnel to re-emerge in the autumn of 1997, collar turned up, long feet like blades carving through the rain. My God, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's spectacular.
There are so many things going on in that we can talk about. But just to stick with your precise question, It's about the bigger question about what it seems to you I might be chasing. Here, it's obviously about bodies, right? It's about bodies, but as physical entities that are also meaning objects, right? And how those two things fit together or don't fit together. And I suppose just to kind of pull out for a second, because you asked about sort of from book to book, my first book was about my family. It was a lot of it was about my mother who died when I was quite young. And a lot of it is about the memory of kind of physical moments to do with her body, to do with illness and so on. My second book was about hypochondria. I've written a book about ruins. And here we are now looking at these sentences that are kind of falling apart as well as pulling themselves together. And I suppose that must be it, right? At some level, is this kind of sense that writing or that art is the thing that is somehow going to console, that is going to hold things together, but it's also somehow going to open up, to use your phrase, it's going to open up the possibility of some kind of vulnerability and wound. And I suppose that must be it. With this book, it completely wasn't intentional, just absolutely not. I set out to just to have some fun with these sentences, and I ended up sounding exactly like myself. There's so much more to say about that Mantel sentence. We could spend the rest of our time on it. It was weirdly picked up by, I think, the Sunday Times at the end of that year, which I guess was 2017, of course, as top sued of the year, literary sued of the year, which is one reason to love it, of course, right?
It's a very beautiful sentence. Everyone obviously has to buy Brian's book, but particularly for that essay, which I am very much admire. About halfway through, I wrote you an email, which I didn't send, which said, this book is the cousin of Camera Lucida. And then the next essay was a Roland Barthes essay. So I didn't send the email because it sounded like I just had got to that point. But I was really interested. Camera Lucida is Barthes' book in which, after the death of his mother, in fact, he sets out to look at a series of pictures and try and understand their hold on him, their power, their effect. And it seems to me that this sort of mode of address to the sentence has all sorts of similarities, but Barthes is such a major figure for you anyway. He's such an influence. You talk about him with the sentence that you choose from his work, but he crops up all over the place in your body of work. Can we talk about him and about his sentences, which are in translation for a start?
This is the thing. My French is not good enough to have spent an awful lot of time with Barthes in French, though I have tried over decades. So like a lot of people, including some very great writers about Barthes, like Wayne Kestenbaum, for example, his relationship with Barthes is very much his relationship with Richard Howard, a poet who has translated most of what we know of Barthes in English. What I'm really interested in, and the sentence that I've chosen in this book, is the way that he writes about duff, material, bodies, but also food. He's such a writer, you know, for somebody who is still somehow thought of as the theorist of various things, he's such an extraordinary writer about materiality. So I guess that's the thing that I'm attracted to now. The first thing that attracted me to Barthes when I was a teenager, I'm embarrassed to say, when I was about 16, was the weirdness of his syntax, or at least Richard Howard's version of the weirdness of his syntax, and the very, very strange punctuation, the kind of pile up of colons, the constant parentheses, and so on. I think I was just really thrilled by the kind of bristling quality of that on the page. And maybe this is something that we'll talk about in a while, but you said to me recently that you thought that this was in some ways quite a teenage book. And I think that that's absolutely right.
I didn't mean that like a criticism.
No, I didn't take it as one either. I think that it's absolutely right. I think it has something to do with a slightly kind of naive, but also kind of reaching, pretentious in the best way, kind of urge to emulate or to see something in these writers, just as you would in music or in a movie star or something, to kind of own up to the fact of your being entranced or fascinated, and see where that can take you. alongside whatever else expertise or knowledge or whatever else you might have got along the way.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think the reason I'd said that is because it reminded me suddenly and vividly of being a teenager in my bedroom, which was painted purple, and writing on the wall sentences that had obsessed me. So there was a sentence from William Burroughs, there was one from William Faulkner, there was one from Jack Kerouac. You can see the sort of things I was reading. But that sense of it, almost being intoxicated by the beautiful sentence, the strange sentence, the sentence that went slightly beyond the limits of your understanding, that felt to me like a teenage thing. And we're so much drawn as adults and as professional critics into connoisseurship, and there's something about just saying that really stunned me, that really entranced me, that feels like we should be doing more of it. It feels exciting to revel in language in that sort of way, and so few people, Wayne Kirstenbaum being one of the notable exceptions, really do that.
Yeah, slightly beyond the bounds of your comprehension or abilities or and world. That's absolutely it, I think. Yeah.
And inevitably, a lot of those romantic sentences, they're kind of gothic sentences. They have very rich language. They have complicated structure, like Thomas Brown, like John Donne. But obviously, you're a great admirer of Beckett, and I wanted to talk about Beckett's bare language, but also the very surprising sentence you chose, which is not one that I think anyone would expect.
Shall I give you the Beckett sentence? This might be the longest one that I read right now, but it's not terribly long, is it? I think it can stand to be read. It's from an essay, or rather a radio monologue, that Beckett wrote in 1946 after he had been working for an Irish Red Cross hospital in France. And he writes this radio address, which is never actually recorded or delivered, and was kind of lost for decades. It was rediscovered in the 80s and republished. And he's describing the relationship between the Irish staff at the hospital and the French staff. What was important was not our having penicillin when they had none, nor the unregarding munificence of the French Ministry of Reconstruction, as it was then called, but the occasional glimpse obtained by us in them, and also, who knows, by them in us, for they are an imaginative people, of that smile at the human condition as little to be extinguished by bombs as to be broadened by the elixirs of Burroughs and Welcome, the smile deriding, among other things, the having and the not having, the giving and the taking, thickness and health. It's not Beckett in many respects, right?
It encapsulates the Beckettian ethos without sounding anything like Beckett.
Yeah, it's curious. Two of Beckett's greatest scholars and critics, Stephen Connor and Simon Critchley, have written about this sentence. And I didn't realize this until I had chosen it and started to write about it and then discovered what they had to say. Connor hates it and thinks that it's an example of everything that Beckett had to get over as a writer, including his use of commas. So he sees it as a kind of willfully kind of inhuman in the wrong way, and pretentious expression of Beckett's kind of youthful persona and worldview. Critchley thinks it's absolutely, and the whole essay it comes from, is absolutely one of the best expressions of Beckett's darkest comedy. So there you go. I could have chosen many, many more elegant and perfect and condensed moments in Beckett, but something about it kind of struck me, and maybe it is a strange kind of striving or reaching on his part. He's trying really hard to impress somebody in that sentence. And if it's the audience, the planned audience for this radio address, it's very strange.
It's interesting how sort of torrent you are or interested you are in younger writers' efforts, that the Joan Didion sentence you choose as well is a young person sentence, and a writer who hasn't quite got control. The Virginia Woolf sentence as well is not quite in control, and somebody in the way that young writers do, chancing their arm, trying out their very best effects, maybe not quite as sleekly or controlledly as you might do later. I like that those found a place in it, that you didn't reject those, and in fact you found excitement in them.
Yeah, this is something that I certainly hadn't planned, and I didn't even realise as I was going along that I was choosing, as you say, in not in every respect, obviously, but some of the time, essay sentences rather by younger writers who became much more successful or well known later on. The Didion is maybe the best example of that. I came across in an interview, but then also in a preface that she wrote to her one collection. It's only three short stories, or one short collection of short fiction in the early 80s, a moment where she describes working for Vogue in the late 50s and early 60s and writing photo captions. And these captions would be worked and reworked. She would get into her editor, who would wield the pencil, and they would go through this thing. And her editor later said, "We wrote long and we published short, and that's how Joan became a writer." So it's about this kind of polishing and sculpting of sentences. So she writes this thing. It's from 1965. It's in Vogue. It's describing, it goes with a feature on Dennis Hopper. And Didion wrote the photo captions to this article. And it goes opposite, above, all through the house, color, verve, improvised treasures in happy but anomalous coexistence. It's perfect. It's perfect, but it's also a lie. She wrote a much longer caption, which was published. And then when she wrote about it later in the 80s, rewrote it. And that's kind of what's fascinating to me, is that the mature, brilliant, you know, the Didion we know, whose prose is so crystalline and so perfect, looks back at the younger trainee Didion, the Didion in waiting, and rewrites her sentence. It seems like such an insight into the level of attention that somebody pays to their own language. And of course, in fact, just this afternoon, I was looking again at Didion's essay from, I think it's from the 90s, on Hemingway. And, you know, part of the Didion legend is her typing and retyping passages from Hemingway in order to hear the rhythms, in order to learn to be a writer. And the kind of attention she pays to word choices, to sound, to punctuation in his writing is just delicious. So you can quite imagine that this writer in early middle age would want to go back and rewrite herself.
Unbearable but, to the perfect Didion ear. I love the sense of that. This is a book that provoked a huge amount of thinking. I found it very involving to read. And one of the questions that I had, and that I, not just for you, but for myself, was, are there writers that this mode of inquiry excludes? Are there writers whose pyrotechnics are not carried out on the sentence level? Are there writers who work on a paragraph level, a chapter level, even a whole book level, but whose sentences might be in some ways sort of dreary or plain or lacking excitement? And I wondered, for a start, whether Austin is one of those, but if there are other people who you love but you excluded because of that.
Mm. Austin's a really good example. I mean, I'm a huge admirer and possibly not lover of Austin. So I really admire all of the things in terms of her prose that other people do. The kind of the clarity of it, the levels of irony in it. And somehow nothing kind of catches my ear, nothing stays in the mind over decades.
Even though and, the person, Pride and Prejudice is probably the most famous
yeah,
sentence.
Of course. But somehow, this is a failing in me, I guess, or it's the limitation, it's a certain limitation of what I'm setting out to do in this book, but also describes maybe certain kinds of limitations in me as a reader, is that I'm drawn to a certain kind of texture. And those are the things that I've picked up on in the book. I think it's probably absolutely true that there are writers whose sentences are not sufficiently textured to draw my attention. But I think it's probably also true that there are writers whose sentences are complex and strange and nonetheless too right, too perfected to be in this book as well. So that I have a list early on in the book of people I'm shocked, having written it, to find are not in it, including, you know, Proust and Zabold and Joyce and Lydia Davis and many others. So there is the other direction, you know, there are sentence mongers who are so concerned with their sentences that somehow they've kind of evaporated from this book at least.
I think one of the real pleasures for me, and perhaps for everybody, is that you, as you're reading, you're assembling your own sort of canon of sentences and thinking, well, why didn't he put in such and such? And I would argue for this one. It makes you readdress all kinds of things that you've read and think over sentences that have charmed or puzzled you. Now, a great rush of sentences have arrived in this chat box. I'm going to read one out. From Aaron, is there any writer or sentence that you wish had made it into the book or that you would add now? And to that, I'd add that you say in the introduction that there's a writer you wanted to include but found you couldn't, which I've been desperate to know ever since.
Because I wasn't up to the job. Is that the phrase? I think at that stage I had Proust in mind, actually, that somehow I couldn't find the right sentence. I couldn't find the kind of critical resources to be able to do that. But there are actually other writers mentioned in the introduction. The one that rises to the front of my mind as soon as I hear that question is Tim Robinson, the Yorkshire writer who lived most of his writing career in Ireland, on the Aran Islands and then in Connemara, and wrote two volumes of Stones of Aran. This extraordinary study of landscape, of history, of humanity. And his sentences, I mean, it really is, you know, mention Proust, it really is as if Proust had disappeared, you know, to the west of Ireland for 50 years and just doggedly described what he saw in exactly the way that Proust described what he saw. So there's a sentence, Robinson died literally as I was writing the introduction to this. When I got to the end, I discovered that Tim Robinson had died. And that's kind of my one regret, actually, is that I didn't have time or resources to go back and pick a sentence. The sentence of his that's in the book is not in the book as one that I pay enough attention to, but it's mentioned early on. Of course, the justness of a word sometimes resides in the precise degree of discomfort it inflicts. There are many other greats. So that Tim Robinson, I think, would be the answer.
From Wendy, in a time of a great many politicians' incoherence here and in the UK, in America and in the UK, I'm guessing, are there any UK politicians whose sentences inspire, enrich or delight you? That's a brilliant question.
Oh, my God.
Is it Boris?
No, sorry, there aren't. God, one of the questions early on with this book was, would it just be literary sentences or could it include, you know, song lyrics and, you know, movie dialogue? But also really important question, political speeches.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. I decided that kind of rhetoric, no matter how brilliant, wasn't something for this book. It is extremely hard to think in this country, as in others, about when the last moment was that one felt like there was a language, a political language that that roused or comforted or inspired? Yeah, it's I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that.
Actually, so often what's good in political rhetoric comes from the Bible anyway, that those sort of phrases and those sort of rhythms are borrowed from biblical language. It's often stolen, those
politicians. Yeah, of course.
I like this question because I have been wondering about it too. This is Claire's question. I wonder about the sentence as in verdict side of the sentence, and if your book hinges on that as well.
Sentence as in verdict.
Mm.
That's, yeah, interesting. The finality of a sentence, the sentence is something that kind of sets something irrevocably in motion. You could imagine another version of this book that dealt with those sentences that have that kind of performative quality. The most benign version of which is, you know, the language of a ceremony like the marriage ceremony, the most malign of which, of course, is the sentence, the condemning sentence. I guess that one answer to that is to say one of the things that the literary sentence gives us is equivocality, right? Is a certain refusal of finality. Maybe that's a banal or easy thing to learn about literary language. I think that I was also shying away in some respects from sentences that were overtly, but the kind of especially sort of essayistic or sometimes novelistic sentence that I think is very much valued in British literature still, or certain generations, certain kinds of literature, the sentence that somehow skewers some part of the world, you know, that condemns. And that's part of a kind of political rhetoric as well, no matter what politics it's emerging from. So there aren't sentences here from that kind of witty, skewering, violent kind of political rhetoric, whether it's satirical or radical or conservative, because I'm trying to shy away from, and maybe there is a kind of politics in this. Someone like Barthes would absolutely say that there is, shying away from the sentence that is too sure of itself.
Yeah, it's Barthes' sense of the neutral and having sentences that are ambiguous or that might just shift between meanings and give you a feeling of spaciousness. I think that's part of the reason that I found it so, like many people, I've been finding it hard to read during lockdown and post-lockdown. And this was a book that felt like it was full of open windows. It felt like you could go in many different directions from it. And I think that's a very rare quality and a quality very much to be celebrated right now, the sense of openness and multiplicity of meaning. What do you think, asks Alan Pulvinus, about what are your feelings about epically long sentences in Faulkner, even the subgenre of book-length sentences? Another good question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for, as readers of this book will discover, I'm all for long sentences. But actually, my idea of a long sentence, at least in the book, is relatively short, and I can actually show you rather than tell you exactly what I mean by turning to page 77 and saying, here is the longest sentence in the book from Virginia Woolf, from her essay on being ill, and it's only something like 20 lines or so. I like the complexity of that. It's like a very complex thought somehow held in the head, whereas the really epic sentence that the question is describing is something very different. One of my favorite fictions or short stories is Donald Barthelme's story Sentence, which I think is about five to seven pages. It's about many things. It's about relationship, it's about the collapse of a relationship, but it's about the adventure of a sentence as well. And obviously there are many examples, especially lately it seems, of novel length sentences or sentence length novels, whichever way around you should describe that. I have a long sentence at the start of the book, but it's only 2 pages, and maybe there's some element in my own writing that isn't able to embark on quite that epic adventure. You have to be so sure, you have to be so comfortable with losing your to write those long sentences. It's true in Proust as well, I think. You have to be so sure that not even that you will find your way back, but that somehow that the adventure is enough.
Sort of related, Matt asks, did you consider including or look into the work of outsider artists who may not be writing in a self-reflexive way, whose sentences could be described as automatic and free of intention or craft?
I'm not sure that I thought specifically about outsider artists, but the question is a very, very good one. And maybe it's a question that the book doesn't quite kind of address, is the language.
I feel like the book moves around this. I'm thinking of De Quincey in particular. The book revolves around the question of control and loss of control, yes, actually quite intensely. Who's in control? Who isn't in control? What does it feel like when they're out of control? Do you as reader like it?
Yeah, I think that's true. And in a way, that's kind of what we were talking about earlier when we talked about kind of the well-made thing versus the thing that's somehow kind of falling apart. I think at the same time that I probably have shied slightly away from the more extreme versions of that. Some people find Gertrude Stein to be that, right? To be the writer who is somehow out of control, whose language is a kind of pile-up of a fragmentary pile-up of things that are already filled with fragmentary relationship and so on. I don't. The thing that interests me in Stein, I think, is tone. And that seems to be, that carries so much in her prose. But people hear different things. And I suppose one of the things I hope that I left open was that some people will read the long sentences in this book and think, Christ, that's a long sentence. And others will think, that fits nicely on the page, you know. It's really interesting, especially when you teach, how people hear structure differently, how readers inhabit those things differently. And I do think that probably the shortest sentence in this book, the Bronte sentence, or the three-letter sentence, which actually, if we think about it as four, or maybe it's five words, is longer than the Bronte sentence, which is from Shakespeare, and it simply goes, oh, 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 that those are in themselves epic.
I had a question about that, because that cry, oh, 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 your first sentence in the book, also recurs at the end. And I wondered whether some of the sentences that you find exciting are exciting because they're stuttering at the very edge of the unsayable, that they're just on the brink between being able to communicate experience and breaking down entirely in the face of pain and trauma, and that sort of rent made graphic, made visible in language, is something that excites us in some way. It moves us in some way. Oh, oh, oh is one of the most moving bits in Shakespeare.
Yes, it's Hamlet's last words, if they are words, at least in one text of the play. And it's elsewhere in Shakespeare. It's in Lear and in Macbeth, and in Othello, there are these moments of ohs, just as, you know, Lear also has his no, 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 no. Maybe there's another no. But those moments, as you say, exactly where this thing that is still succeeding in being expressive and making sense on the page or on the stage and in the voice is also edging towards being just a kind of animal cry. And I was really amazed when I got to the end of the book. This, again, was not intentional. I got to the end of the book writing about Anne Boyer, writing about garments against women. And she tells this story via Rousseau, who's writing about language, a scene of a girl, a young girl, writing the letter O over and over again. And Boyer makes this point about this is actually her expression. This is actually saying any number of things. This inscription of the OOO. And I wrote that passage and thought, oh, hang on a second, this is exactly where I started. But that was totally unplanned.
And also that feels like it ends with a manifesto for what reading can be, that reading can open up such levels into the text that the skilled reader, the engaged reader, is on a sort of joyous, thrilling detective journey. And I think you make that manifest for the reader, you make them a participant in that, and potentially excite them into continuing it in other texts that they're drawn to. And that feels to me like a wonderful thing to have achieved. Well done.
Thank you.
I think this is probably the final question because we're running out of time, but I wondered if we could touch on what the next sentences coming from you might be. I know there are some books brewing and I thought maybe you could just...
Oh, yeah. I have surprised myself. I have a little book coming out next year, which is a collection of essays mostly about art. It covers some of the art that is in your book of essays, mostly about art from this year. But I have surprised myself with the sentence book, that it has led to a book that is almost entirely about images. It's called Affinities, and it's about the idea of... I realized I was using this word affinity all the time. And in fact, I had a conversation with my partner, Emily LaBarge, the writer, about what I thought I was doing in this book. I wasn't entirely sure what the sentence book was really supposed to be about. And she said, well, isn't it surely about affinity? It's about my connections to these things and how these things connect. And so the next book is about that. It's about the idea of affinity, but it is probably a book about images.
Very exciting indeed. Thank you so much, Brian. And I just want to say before we finish, like all bookshops, the LRB is struggling under the COVID crisis. If you can buy Brian's book, that would be marvellous. If you can buy any books, that would be marvellous. This sort of deep, thrilling world of reading really only exists if there are shops to sell the books in. So please do support them.
Thank you, Olivia. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.